on Inno Latino Podcast.
We have to appreciate ourselves and the stories that we leave behind. The best piece of advice, though, is to remember that the story behind you does not dictate 100% the story in front of you. We have to remove the blinders. This is the lesson that I learned, that we are not on fixed rails, that anything is possible.
That's Jeff Gomez, CEO of Starlight Runner Entertainment. He's a leading expert in the fields of brand narrative and transmedia storytelling. Pretty neat, huh? Now, let me ask you, what kind of narrative rules your life right now? What are the stories that we're telling us as a community or even as a nation? Why is the storytelling so important anyway? Can stories influence lives for good? Have in mind these questions for the next little while, because our guest today is a global authority in storytelling. Jeff's work includes titles like Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean, James Cameron's Avatar, Hasbro's Transformers, Sony Pictures' Spider-Man and Men in Black, Microsoft's Halo, and Nickelodeon's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yep, you heard me. Jeff's work has also been applied to educational and geopolitical causes. Also, at the end of our episode, Jeff has a surprise for us, listeners. This is Inno Latino. Hola, mi gente. Welcome to another edition of Inno Latino Podcast. Let me ask you this. Do you think that a storyteller can actually change the world? Can our stories impact humanity? I'm here to tell you that it is possible because I have a living example of it. My guest today has been not only involved in productions big as with companies as big as Nickelodeon, franchise like Spider-Man, Men in Black, Microsoft, oh, so many productions. He's also worked with governments and international organizations to actually bring peace to humanity. It is with such a pleasure and honor that I introduce to you, Jeff Gomez. Bienvenido, Jeff.
Bienvenido. Hello. How are you doing, Gonzalo?
Excellent. I'm a bit starstruck and really excited to have you here, as a matter of fact. Thank you for accepting my invitation, Jeff.
You're certainly welcome. I'm glad to talk about these subjects.
Of course. First of all, well, I am for the audience, if you are not a Latino, don't worry. No, nobody's perfect. I'm kidding. So we're going to be referring a little bit to our Latino culture, but I don't want to ostracize you. I want you to identify the elements of your culture that you might have forgotten, and then you adopted to build your own narrative and stories, okay? So, Jeff, the Latino experience, I understand you're New Yorkican, am I right?
That's right.
And yet you had the chance to visit the island a lot of times growing up. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience and how that influenced the influence with your culture, please?
Sure. I grew up on Houston Street and the East River Drive in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the early 1960s. This was largely an Hispanic neighborhood, primarily Puerto Rican. There were Blacks there, other ethnic minorities, but there were a whole lot of Puerto Ricans. I grew up there, but in the late 1960s, around 69, my dad and mom got a divorce, and my father moved to Bayamón, Puerto Rico, where he lived for many, many years after that. During the summers, my mom would send me to be with Jose in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So I would be there from late June to early September for maybe 10 or 12 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you had that contact constantly, am I right?
Well, it was fairly consistent. And of course, for me, it was not the most comfortable of situations. I was a kind of brainy kid, very much into my own head. I didn't care about learning Spanish. I was very detached from my Puerto Rican heritage. And of course, the island was hot and there were a lot of bugs. And
Very different from the Manhattan scene, am I right?
Yes, yes. So it was, you know, in the early going, it was not easy for me. And I was uncomfortable, frankly, with my Latino heritage. It was only when I got older that I started to get a little more comfortable.
You told me a story about growing up and when you visited the island, there was something which you could take refuge from everything else. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, you know, any port in a storm, as they say.
Uh-huh.
I was starved for, you know, intellectual stimulation. And what happened is, you know, all of my father's friends and his family, you know, everyone in Puerto Rico has a little nook with books in it, library. And a lot of those books are in English. So I would sneak off and ransack the bookshelves looking for something. It could be anything. You know, early on, it was the dictionary or the encyclopedia. Later it was, you know, popular paperback novels. This is the 1970s. So I'm reading and reading and reading. And I read books like Think and Grow Rich.
Oh, okay.
You know, hey, that was pretty handy.
Yes.
I'm like 7, 8, 9 years old. I read The Exorcist.
Oh, wow.
And then there was a book on my tia's shelf called The Hobbit. And I asked her about it. And she said, oh, yeah, it's really nice. You would like it a lot. And so I read it. And I learned, I loved it. But in the back of the book, it said, you know, there are more books. There's a sequel called The Lord of the Rings. This was one of the nicest things my papi ever did for me, is he purchased the three Lord of the Rings novels for me.
Oh, yes.
I was set for life, because that was a story world that was so convincing and so rich and so complex that I began to study story worlds. And of course, your audience may not know this, but I'm the CEO of Starlight Runner Entertainment, and I am specializing in helping Hollywood studios and video game companies and publishers and even theme parks to develop their intellectual property across multiple media platforms. In essence, I am building worlds the way, in some ways, that Tolkien did with that very first book, The Hobbit.
Oh, nice. Well, the geeking me is, as you can imagine, really, really, really excited right now. You've worked with like EA games, am I right? And you've taken some of the great franchises into different media, like video games and across platforms, even comic books, am I right?
Sure, sure. Yes, I worked for comic book companies. People who played games in the 1990s will remember Turok Dinosaur Hunter for the Nintendo.
Yes.
I worked on Halo for Microsoft 343 Studios. Many, many games. Need for Speed for EA. Figuring out how these rich, complex worlds, these systemic worlds operate, is a specialty that is rooted in my rooting around people's bookshelves in Puerto Rico. Sure, sure. In Puerto Rico, I was so interested in how to create worlds of make-believe. And I would watch TV shows like Ultraman, you know, Puerto Rican television imported a lot of inexpensive Japanese content in the late 60s and early 70s because it was cheap, but also because it was awesome.
Yes, yes, in Latin America, it happened. I grew up watching the reruns of Ultraman, and I love it.
Ultraman, Ultra Siete,
Ultra Siete,
Monstruos del Espacio, León Blanco, Kimba the White
Lion. Kimba the White Lion, yes.
So, you know, what was so fascinating to me about those, and some of them were in Spanish, but I would try, that's how I learned Spanish. I was so eager to understand these cartoons and these TV shows. And what was interesting about those shows were they were very serious. They took themselves seriously.
Yes.
They were serialized, meaning that, what happened in the last episode mattered to this episode and the next and the next. In America, very few cartoons were like chapters or serials.
That's correct.
Learning this kind of long-form storytelling was a vital to teaching myself how to create fantastical worlds. Also, I started to study games because Dungeons and Dragons had been popular in the 1970s. So I was running Dungeons and Dragons games at home in New York. When I'd have to go to Puerto Rico, there was nothing to do. I was alone. So I would create these very elaborate worlds with deep histories and hundreds of different characters, and I would draw maps of my world, like the maps.
Wow.
And so when I came home to run my games, the players were, it was like awesome for them because they could go anywhere and do anything, and there'd be all this detail and all these characters and interesting storylines, no matter what direction they moved. This is the open world model that we see today in Star Wars and Marvel Cinematic Universe and so forth. So there's a demand for this kind of storytelling, and so I have a job.
Beautiful. I love it. There is a particular franchise that I would like you to touch on briefly. Is because I have relatives, including my brother, who really love it, and it's Magic the Gathering. There was one anecdote that you told me that, I don't know if you were producing a comic book for the franchise of Magic, and at that point, you have developed a closer relationship with your culture, your Latino heritage. Yes. Can you tell me a little bit about it, please? Can you tell me a little bit about it and how your culture played a role in it, please?
Well, you know, remember, Gonzalo, I had a little bit of a hot and cold relationship with Puerto Rico, my Puerto Rican heritage. My father was a tough guy. I was shy and sensitive. I felt so different from him that for many years, being Latino didn't matter much to me. While I was at the Valiant Comic Book Company, I helped them to secure the rights to Magic the Gathering, this trading card game, which was hugely popular in the schools and so forth. I had been a school teacher right out of college, so I knew what bothered and that card game was bothering them because Magic the Gathering. So I convinced Valiant to go get the license, and nobody understood the game, so I had to write the comic books, which was very good.
Yes.
Money. I wrote the first issues, and they showed me the mock-up of the covers, which were beautiful. And then I thought to myself, you managed to get out of the projects, the Lower East Side, where so many of my friends who were Latino were still there. And then I taught school in the 80s and not much had changed. There were still so many Hispanic and Latino and Black children in poverty in my own city. And here I was making good money, and there was a comic book that I had written. So I asked the staff to put my name on the cover. It was unusual at the time in the 1990s to have your name on the cover of a comic book. And I said, that's Gomez with an accent over the O.
Para que lo sepan.
You know, they did it, and the my bosses frowned on it because, you know, what made me so special. And I said, listen, you know, it's time for that name to be on the cover of something.
No, and Frank Carohan, if you just heard this, es tiempo, it's time, am I right?
You know. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And ever since then, it's one of the reasons why I do the kind of promotion that I do. You know, I could easily stay in the behind the scenes creating these worlds and helping my clients, but you know, I was one of those kids, you know, and there is a ladder that we can climb to success from that situation. And I want to let people know that it is possible.
Thank you. One of the reasons why I started this podcast is because we need to change the narrative that sometimes in our own culture we have imposed ourselves. Now, please no one think that I'm piling on Latino culture. I'm just saying that there are positive aspects and negative aspects of any culture. I think that sometimes the whole machismo thing, or thinking that you are destined to be poor, or that is ill conceiving that you find a way to make good money and that makes you a bad person, or to try to make it and prove yourself in any way. Those are the things that's the type of narrative that I don't want our people to perpetuate. And we need examples like yours. And thank you for communicating those ideals, Jeff.
Absolutely, Gonzalo. In fact, the ladder that I climbed started the first time that I saw my own home, my neighborhood on television. You know, it never occurred to me that anybody would care about the Baruch projects, but the first shot in the first episode of Sesame Street, Plaza Sesame, is my projects.
Wow.
You know, they showed kids in a playground, and behind them is my projects building, and then of course the first scene in Sesame Street is like looks like, you know, El Barrio.
El Barrio, yes.
And there's Big Bird, you know, walking in and talking to you know, a Black man and a Latina child, as if they're, you know, respectable, wonderful people. Didn't see much in the 1960s.
Yes.
And so I thought to myself, wow, you know, fantasy is not over in England. Fantasy is not on another planet. The beauty of fantasy and enchantment can be right here in my neighborhood. And somebody made this show. And so somebody cares enough to speak to me about such things.
Wow.
Even in my little child subconsciousness, that a story can be told about me and about what I care about. And this was the first rung on a ladder that I climbed to leave poverty, and to be able to stand with James Cameron while shooting Avatar, or to speak with Johnny Depp about Pirates of the Caribbean in a creative fashion. You know, these are things I could never have dreamed, except that I was climbing because I could see myself. I could picture myself in these kinds of situations.
That is beautiful. And well, if I understand correctly, you would like us, our people, to do the same, to project ourselves in those aspects, you know, climbing that ladder, not getting stuck, you know.
And we get stuck because the natural psychology, human psychology, is confirmation. to confirm your personal biases. I'm right. So if you're a child growing up in a situation which is very limited, what else do you know? You know, it's this is right. I belong here. You know, I don't belong anywhere else. Maybe I can fantasize about being a rap star or a basketball star, but those are just fantasies. Very rarely does it happen. Story shows you that there is another way. A story indicates how there can be paths out of the reality that you're living in. And the only difference between myself and many of my peers in that neighborhood was I chose to believe in the possibility of those other paths. That's it.
That is beautiful. Thank you. Now, at a certain point, you have realized the power of the story in itself. And you decided to take that to a different level, to make the world a better place, to affect change, not only in the United States, but in other areas. You, for example, Colombia, who had been, had this conflict with the guerrilla, the FARC and ELN, and you help in some ways heal through storytelling. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, a part of the skill that I had developed over the years was to make my clients, who were movie companies and video game companies, understand the psychology of the fan.
Okay.
Right? So if I love something, I'm going to want more, right? I'm going to chase it. I'm going to pay good money for issue number 2 and issue number 3 and issue number 4, or I'm going to go back to see the movie part 2, part 3, part 4, right?
Yes.
Those things are actions that are taken by fans. And when the fan loves the property enough, they start to get in touch with each other to talk about it, right?
That's right.
In the old days, it was with, you know, newsletters and fanzines and clubs and conventions. But today, it's instantaneous. We can connect with each other and become a big fan base for our favorite properties. And then we can take action. We can talk. We can create content. We can analyze the story and get more excited about what's going to happen next. So if you understand how that works, in my mind, I started to write about how we can make people understand how to take better care of themselves.
Hey.
So if there is ignorance, we can help to promote being literate and to benefit from more education. If there was corruption in our government, we can take action because we feel strongly that it's better if it's not corrupt. We can take action to raise our voice in unison to push back at corruption or to push back at organized crime. Or push back at extremism, right?
Yes.
So I wrote about those things, and to my surprise, I was contacted by people in the Obama administration who said, "Listen, can you tell us a little bit more?"
Wow.
How to make a kind of fan base behave, like organize themselves and behave to make things better. And I said, sure, I'll talk to you about that. We have to make sure that it's for progressive positive causes and so forth. And they said, well, all right. I think they'd like to do, you know.
They're side of this political spectrum.
But they did. And, you know, they funded research into creating models and programs that can impact entire peoples. This is something that I called transmedia population activation. And the first big project was in Mexico, where we talked about how to push back at cartel violence, you know, and this project actually did help for the Mexican people to organize themselves better and demand that the government take more care and that the cartels cool it, back off a little bit.
Yeah,
and that was successful, and that was noticed by the administration of Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, and we went down there to examine the trauma that had been left over from the Colombian Civil War, and how to address this trauma so that young people can be more leadership oriented and entrepreneurial, and so that the peace process can be accelerated between the government and the FARC.
Wow, beautiful. And at a certain point, then I assume that you analyzed the narrative that and the stories that were being told. And you had to have that vision to see how people saw themselves and how they saw or perceived the counterpart. What did you do about it?
Well, it all goes back to fishing through those books in Puerto Rico. Uh-huh. the great truth that I discovered about humanity is that the stories that we told ourselves thousands of years ago are still relevant today in terms of the underlying values for human life, for the pursuit of enlightenment, for the pursuit of self-improvement. If you look at the great myths from all over the world, those myths were basically like instruction books. They were designed to help us become better human beings, right? That is the purpose of story. So the key to a project like what happened in Colombia is to understand the narratives of the indigenous Colombian culture. What is the mythology of Colombia? What are the underlying values that all Colombians share? They come out of those legends. So in discerning them, we are able to find common ground between these opposing sides. And by understanding the history of Colombia, the actual historic record, we can see where invaders would come in and do damage to those narratives. They would warp them or even break them, destroy them. And this pitted Colombians against one another and created fractures in their sense of cultural identity. When you diagnose the fractures and know exactly what happened, you are able to write a prescription. Uh-huh. And that prescription is story, a universal story, a foundational narrative for the entire country, where if it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you are pointing to that story and going, that's my story. Okay, those are my values. Those are the values of the Colombian people. When you have that, you then can infuse that core narrative into the different media, into the telenovelas, into the radio shows, into the church, right? Even the church, and into government. And when you tell a story that is in unison, you stop fighting and can start to heal and prosper. And that is the sort of thing that we did in Colombia, in Mexico, in Australia, in Canada. We've done it all over the world.
This is most admirable, and I'm very, I'm speechless at the moment.
Let me be clear.
Yes.
These are not easy things to do.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, there's a lot of work that takes place.
A lot of work. It requires the cooperation of many different people. We need access to data. We need to speak with the people of the nation, in this case, Colombia. We spoke with thousands of people gathering their micro narratives so that we can understand completely what happened and how to create stories that would address it. But you know, there is a precedent for this kind of work even before I came along. The Sabido method. Sabido was created by this gentleman, Sabido, where he infused in telenovelas little gotitas de saber.
drops of knowledge.
Exactly. Which helped housewives to improve their lives, go to school, become more emancipated. And we see this again in the work of Norman Lear, the American television producer who created All in the Family and Good Times and The Jeffersons, where issues concerning race and bigotry and prejudice and many other issues were discussed publicly on television for the first time, which fostered a dialogue for the people of the United States, which created an incredible kind of progressive movement.
That is so excellent. And well, what I see is that in places like Colombia, where, you know, let's be clear, there are still many challenges ahead and present. However, we definitely see a decrease from the violence that we saw during the 80s and 90s. And violence that was a lot longer occurring. And I see how these narratives have been adopted, that you're talking about, have been adopted into our main culture, you know, the mainstream culture. And I assume in places like Canada and Australia as well. So thank you on behalf of those who have benefited from that undercurrent of positive values and that we've taken for granted, Jeff. So thank you. And in closing, to finish our interview on an even better note, what would you tell those who think that do not have a good story to tell, that my story is too different from everyone else and it's not going to cause any impact? What would you tell them?
That's a great question. I would tell them the same thing that I tell my big corporate clients or the top executives. The beauty and the artistry of narrative, of story, is that there are things that everyone has in common, because we want to live, we want to prosper, we want to love, we want to do things that improve ourselves, our families, maybe the world. So we have that all in common. The thing that makes you special is that there is a filter between your eyes and your past, and that is your brain. And when things move through that filter into your brain and then into your past, that leaves behind a unique narrative. And there's only that story. And the more unique, the better, right? We all want to have an interesting, a good story to enjoy.
Yes.
We have to appreciate ourselves and the stories that we leave behind. The best piece of advice, though, is to remember that the story behind you does not dictate 100% the story in front of you, okay? So we have to remove the blinders. We are not on a rail track. We are in the open field and can walk in any direction to fulfill ourselves and to contribute something good to the world. This is the lesson that I learned from all those books and all those movies and games, that we are not on fixed rails, that anything is possible as long as we understand the practicality of moving in the direction we want to move.
Excellent. Beautiful. There you have it, folks. Yes.
I want to give a little plug.
Yes, please.
Well, you know, in this past year, it's been very, very hard, I think, for so many of us. And the one thing that I have done in my living and for a living is to give advice to big executives and the people who run these studios, but also to politicians and people who are organizing large numbers of people. I have a service called Starlight Runner Life Story, and I am offering to your listeners the opportunity to have that kind of conversation with me, but not at the price that I usually charge to those people. It's time to have a little Latino power.
Yes.
Help one another. So if you reach out to me at jeff@starlightrunner.com, maybe you can put a link when you post the podcast. We can talk about my having a few conversations. It's like six sessions where we talk about your creativity, your blockages, and how to navigate the business of story, no matter what type of story you want to tell.
Can you repeat one more time your email address so our listeners can write it down?
I'm an easy Google, so just a moment. But it's jeff@starlightrunner.com, spelled just like it sounds.
Excellent. Thank you so much. There you have it, the storyteller, the healer, the peacemaker, Jeff Gomez. Gracias.
Anya, you are doing a service for us all. I love your podcast and can't wait until you invite me back.
And I look forward for that, okay? Thank you. Un abrazo, mi gente. Nos vemos.
Hey, don't go anywhere. Jeff Gomez has still a little surprise for us.
I want to give a little plug.
Yes, please.
Well, you know, in this past year, it's been very, very hard, I think, for so many of us. And the one thing that I have done in my living and for a living is to give advice to big executives and the people who run these studios, but also to politicians and people who are organizing large numbers of people. I have a service called Starlight Runner Life Story. And I am offering to your listeners the opportunity to have that kind of conversation with me, but not at the price that I usually charge to those people. It's time to have a little Latino power.
Yes.
Help one another. So if you reach out to me at jeff@starlightrunner.com, maybe you can put a link when you post podcast. We can talk about my having a few conversations. It's like six sessions where we talk about your creativity, your blockages, and how to navigate the business of story, no matter what type of story you want to tell.
Can you repeat one more time your email address so our listeners can write it down?
Sure. I'm an easy Google, so just a moment. But it's jeff@starlightrunner.com, spelled just like it sounds.
Excellent. Thank you so much. There you have it, the storyteller, the healer, the peacemaker, Jeff Gomez. Gracias.
Anya, you are doing a service for us all. I love your podcast and can't wait until you invite me back.
And I look forward for that, okay? Thank you. Un abrazo, mi gente. Nos vemos.